The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world. And we talk about those things which are going on in various parts of our world, and we kind of look at them through the prism of our Catholic wisdom, our Catholic social thought, and we try to see if we can make a little bit of sense about it as to kind of how we can make our world more just and more compassionate. And even if we're not looking at those big global issues, we just kind of say, just love God, your neighbor, yourself. And if each of us did that, our world would be more just and it would be more compassionate. So continued a blessed Advent as we are really, really drawing near to Christmas. By the way, we get cheated this year. I just want everybody to know we get cheated because the fourth Sunday of Advent is the day before Christmas, December 24th. So we don't get any of the weekdays of the fourth week of Advent. So it's kind of a truncated Advent, but so we get to celebrate Christmas a little bit quicker than we do some years. I guess that's not really true because it's always December 25th. But anyway, so no fourth week of Advent, just the fourth Sunday of Advent, Christmas Eve, and then we go right into Christmas. But I am delighted that we are going to be speaking this week with a couple of people who I think have a lot to contribute about kind of how we are dealing with the world these days, in which there's a lot of stuff that is chaotic. There's a lot of stuff which is really, really extreme. And it seems that only the people on the extremes get news, and they're the only ones who kind of get reported on. So I'm delighted that we're going to have as our first guest, who'll be with us in just a minute, David Gibson, who is the director of the Center for Religion and Culture at Fordham University. He's only been in that position for about 6 months, so we're delighted to hear his take. But he has a wealth of experience as a journalist in various parts of the world. I think he hung out in Rome for a while, so there's a lot of religion going on there, and we even hope a lot of spirituality going on there, but certainly a lot of religion going on there. And so I'm delighted that David's going to be with us. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to have Suzanne Nossel with us, who is going to speak to us about some of the issues going on with news and fake news and attacks on the media. I actually heard a really interesting thing on the radio yesterday. I'm not even sure who it was, but the person I thought made a good point and said, hey, journalism's hard. You got to do a lot of investigating. You got to do a lot of work. It's not just about whatever comes into your mind. And I thought that was a pretty good point that whoever it was made it. So I'm passing it on to you, and I'm glad that we're going to be speaking with Suzanne Nossel later on in the show. So let's do this. Tom, suppose we hold off a little bit on our news notes, and why don't we go right to David Gibson, who has joined us here in the Sirius studios today. I'm delighted that you came in. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Monsignor. Great to be here.
Yeah, and you walked down only a few blocks from where your new office is, right?
Exactly. My new incarnation from a career in journalism, religion coverage, starting at the Vatican, indeed, back when John Paul II was Pope, and moving on to newspapers and magazines here in the New York City area, but now to Fordham University, which my colleagues like to call honest work for the first time in my career. But you know, it's kind of when I started out, by the way, at Vatican Radio,
okay,
back in the 1980s at the Vatican, which is run by the Jesuits.
Okay,
so now I'm back at a Jesuit university.
Okay.
So it's kind of full circle. There's a beautiful poetic kind of pilgrimage going on.
Hey,
there.
Tom, we got to be careful today because we got a real professional who knows what this radio business is about,
as opposed
to me, who kind of just makes it up each week.
I can
we
do
go
our
along.
Call sign, Laudator Jesus Christus. This is Vatican Radio.
See, that's
still got
good.
It. You know?
That is
I'm from New Jersey. The first thing they taught me there was not to talk like I'm from New Jersey.
All right. Well, that's, but you know what I say about us New Yorkers? We are the only people in the country without an accent. So it's, and I admit to all listeners in other parts of the country, I think the rest of the country is wonderful, but you all have accents. We don't here. I mean, and, you know, all those things about R's at the end of the words and AWs, you know, too much is made about that. We don't need all of that. But anyway, so David, I'm delighted that you are with us. So tell us a little bit about your new gig.
Yeah, it's terrific, and I'm really blessed, and I mean that. It's a great environment to be in. I'm at the Lincoln Center campus. You know, Fordham started and was based in the Bronx at Rose Hill.
So to our listeners throughout the country,
exactly.
So let me just set the setting. Most of Fordham University is in the hood, up in the Bronx. It's in the Bronx, a little bit north of the South Bronx, but in a real community neighborhood up there. We're actually a few blocks away from where my grandmother grew up in that part of the Bronx. But they also have one down here in Manhattan, where is, quite frankly, in at the heart of one of the cultural centers of New York City, Lincoln Center, right? Kind of just a block or two south of that big cultural center.
It really is, and it's a growing campus, a growing part of the network of campuses of Fordham, and it's there's a reason that Father Joe McShane, I think years ago, more than a decade ago, started this center on religion and culture down there, because it's really kind of a portal to the wider community. Look, we're in New York City, we're in Manhattan. It's a Jesuit school. It wants to engage the culture. It's not the school. It's not just about educating our students and raising them in the Jesuit Ignatian tradition. It's also about engaging the wider community and saying, hey, look, we have this Catholic intellectual tradition, and we want to be part of this wider community. We want to be part of this wider conversation. So we put on programs, half a dozen programs, conferences a year, panels, open to the public, free to the public, really working to keep it that way, about relevant issues of the day. There's usually, a Catholic, a moral, ethical, Catholic perspective in there, and something that's of concern to the church. But really, they're on issues that can draw in the wider community, people who have any kind of interest in the fate of our society, of our community, of mankind.
So, David, let me ask you a very unfair question, okay? Because you've sold me, okay? You've sold me on that. I think that that's critically important. I think we try to do our little bitty piece here on Just Love on Sirius Radio. And I guess the question, which is unfair, is who cares? I mean, I spent more time myself following last week that we now have out of Brooklyn, we have a beer named after Beyonce. It's Beyonce. So, I mean, that caught my attention. How do we get people engaged in what I admit are the central topics that we really need to be engaged as a society?
Well, I think you're right. That's the challenge. There's so much flitting across our screens. The fact that I did not see the Beyonce thing kind of
I'll send you the link.
It's probably to my credit, but it's also surprising me. I mean, we're on Twitter, we're on social media, we're following all this stuff. And the pace of news and the delivery of all these things at once is so new and in a way informative, but distracts us from deeper thinking, bigger thoughts, bigger issues about our lives, but also about our society. And yet, look, we have to make that effort to try to engage people on a deeper, broader level. And I do believe that audience is there. Look, again, the last couple of years and, with our politics in our country, the polarization in our country, the anger, the hatred, has a lot of people. As you said at the top of the show, these polls and the people on the extremes are getting get a lot of heat and light, generate heat, not so much light. They get a lot of attention, but they don't. But it's the people in the center. A lot of people are asking, who are we? What are we going to become? What is my future? They're asking deeper questions, and we want to put events and programs out there, discussions, debates, honest debates, where like this last one we had just last month about does America have a moral center? We had people, we had Suzanne Nossel, who's going to be your next guest, but also Pete Wenner, conservative evangelical Republican, former Bush administration official on the panel, Zephyr Teachout, liberal law professor at Fordham. Again, people across the spectrum, but people who can speak in a civil, considered way. and disagree. We want to model that conversation. Otherwise, you know, we're lost. I mean, if I think people are hungry for that kind of stuff, we are going to provide it. We need to get out there more. We need to get people in. We need to get younger people involved. We're going to do a lot of programming that I think will appeal to them. But, you know, we can't give up on that mission.
Well, we're speaking with David Gibson, who is a journalist, and he's now the director of the Center for Religion and Culture at Fordham University. So, David, I know you've only been there 6 months, and but as you look at it, what are some of the things on your agenda in either specific topics or ways you'd like to kind of engage to try to kind of grow that center?
You know, we have one thing again is to get the word out there, and you know, being on your show is a great way to do it. I think it's been a little bit.
We have somewhere between 18, 20 listeners who are, and there are millions of their friends who are holding on every word you're saying. So be careful.
Not every word of mine, but every word of yours. But I think that you know, to get the word out there, to let people know that there are these opportunities. It's so easy to despair. Again, when you look at the blather out there and you look at social media, you just kind of want to go back and crawl into your rock. And Christmas is a great time just almost to retreat from that, and family and friends and the hearth. But people, we want to offer an opportunity for people to engage, and especially young people. Like, one of the things I want to that I'm working on is putting together a panel on social protests and civil disobedience and how that worked. You see so many young people out there so energized. They want to protest, but they don't really know how to do it. They do this clicktivism, they call it, where you put a little thing out on Twitter, say, everybody gather here for this Occupy something protest, and people show up. And then they leave, and they think they've done something, but nothing changes. But what I really want to point up is the religious and spiritual grounding of successful civil rights movements, like the civil rights movement in the 60s, for example, and how much that was grounded in the work of the churches and other religions and religious communities. And you look at the Reverend Barber down in North Carolina. You look at Sister Simone Campbell and the nuns on the bus. I want to highlight, bring in to the center, to, you know, some of these leading activists. Look at a fellow, well, a bunch of people, but one of the fellows I'm going to get from the Lakota Sioux tribe, who's been leading the Dakota Pipeline protest, which is not just an environmental cause. It's a religious, spiritual, and moral cause for the Lakota Sioux people out there in North Dakota. So there is that grounding. This is something I think that can get people, younger people, not only interested, but also educate them about how you actually do successful change, you know, how you can be the Dorothy Day of the next generation.
You know, David, I hope our listeners are interested in what we're going to talk about next. I am, so I hope our listeners are. But, I mean, one of the things that I have been for so many years a strong supporter of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. And I realize there's been a lot of controversy about it by some of the extremes. And, you know, probably a minuscule amount of that criticism was justified. But a lot of it was just, in my judgment, over the top, inappropriate, inaccurate. However, my own criticism of the Campaign for Human Development was that methodologically it was stuck in a methodological model of the 70s, 60s, which basically talked about church-based community organizing, which had nothing to do with social media, had nothing to do with a new world. And so what we're trying in the Archdiocese here is a little bit of an experiment for the next 3 years. Can we revitalize it as a campaign for charity and justice, which is a little bit more rooted in parishes and community-based organizations? And we're going to try to figure out how we do that, because I'd like to kind of have a conversation about, well, how do we do organizing social change in this social media era?
Exactly. And it seems to me what you're doing is taking it back to the roots and to the grassroots and connecting it with that kind of thing. Because you know, what I'm concerned to do with, for example, this program on you know, how social movements happen.
Right.
How did abolition happen?
Right.
You know, how did the civil rights movement happen? How did the war on poverty happen? But, you know, you have to, the protesting is both the first and the last step. It's not the, you know, it's all of the organizing and political action that goes on and grassroots mobilizing that goes on between. The hard work is the stuff that you're talking about, how you enact that. And obviously, you know, there was this great social uprising, in the 60s and 70s, but you can kind of get locked in those eras. I think you also see that with the pro-life movement to a degree, which is changing. You had this great, I think, with the March for Life, this great kind of flowering of this outcry and people marching. But what's really interesting to me, and I want to get some of them, are the people who are doing some different things. It's like, look, we can't just gather together and march. That's a great thing. How do we enact this movement into policies? It's the same kind of social movement. And the question is, the problem is, you can get young people who are very energized, but they're going to become cynical if they just show up to things and nothing changes and they don't see any fruit of what they're doing. So you've got to get them involved in a longer term way.
Well, and again, I think this is not only, I think one of the things we also need to understand in the global world that we live in, this is not a phenomenon that's limited to the United States. And I do think there is a very kind of interesting analysis, which I don't know that I understand at all, of the whole Arab Spring and how that uprising is at least attributed by some commentators to social media, the ability to communicate independent of government and formal structures of communication. And then, you know, it seemed to blossom for a while, and then maybe it got even a little bit more oppressive after it didn't blossom. So I think there's something to be learned in that, too.
And yeah, it's very true. The thing, you know, social media and media in general is a double-edged sword. It can magnify these things.
Right.
There's one guy sadly setting himself on fire in Tunisia, wherever it was, kind of sparking this Arab Spring and gives it this kind of great resonance and worldwide acclaim. But out of proportion to the change that it actually did and can happen in that context of the Arab world, my concern is that we're lucky to live in a democracy. And, you know, we don't live in an oppressive regime that can backlash, you know, that can persecute people who try to change things. And yet, what are we doing? Are we doing enough? You look out there at our politics today, this week's election in Alabama, things like that. You know, where are people? When people come out, they can change things. They can make a difference. Whatever side you're on, you've seen when people come out, they can upend the establishment. They can upend the expectations. But it's really remarkable. If you look at most of our elections and midterm elections,
right,
35-40% of registered voters coming out, to me, that's a problem.
It is also that it's also true. And what I have noticing is that because of the way that things are stacked in the things, in order to, in my judgment, to do the right thing, it takes an extraordinary amount of effort and energy to do the right thing. And I have no problem talking about the election that just took place in Alabama. And I'm fully willing to accept the fact that allegations are not proofs of things. Mm-hmm. But I think there is an era in which even serious allegations that people would say, okay, they're not proved, but there needs to be a pause and we need to step aside in order that we don't let this cloud things. But we don't have a decency anymore where there's kind of center which says, yeah, okay, we're not saying guilty, but we're saying we need like a little bit of decency to make things happen. And so, okay, you read all the commentaries, but I mean, the vote was basically 50-50 mm-hmm. on that. So people were rejoicing who felt they won. Mm-hmm. Well, they won by like, boop, just a little bit. And the amount of energy that it took to just that little bit. So it seems to me that, boy, it's becoming increasingly arduous to get the right thing done.
It really is, and you talked about the importance of process and stepping back and not letting these things kind of just take. You know, you almost worry with a lot of the allegations and things that there could be a backlash if something happens. It was interesting in the New York Times just the other day. Zephyr Teachout, a law professor, wonderful person at Fordham, who was also on this panel we had the
other
week.
I'm not sure our governor thinks she's the most
wonderful to liberal Dem. But she wrote the thing regarding Al Franken, saying she thought that it was too hasty in his case. I mean, there are certain cases that you're a private industry. Right. If you're whatever, the Catholic Church, you can do what you want with somebody. You can bar them. You can suspend them, whatever. But she said that, you know, look, here's a public official with some questions about the allegations. We need to go through more of a due process to allow the people who elected him to have a say. That's not a popular opinion. She got a lot of blowback about it, but it was interesting. And I love, actually, she, and again, she was on this panel with Suzanne Nossel. John Carr was on there, former USCCB official, Catholic Church official in Washington. But it was funny, Zephyr Teachout, very much of the left, progressive Democrat, and Pete Wenner, conservative Republican evangelical, had a lot in common, and I think to say in common about the social fragmentation. Zephyr talked about the loneliness. She's run for office a couple times in her campaigning. She said, rightly, again, goes back to this, she said, the best thing you can do is to run for office, to really see what the country's about. It forces you to go talk to people you don't necessarily agree with. You get to see their condition. And both Pete and Zephyr were really poignant and to the point about the social fragmentation and the loss of our bonds of community. Yeah. And they have different policy prescriptions for it. But, you know, at least if we can agree on the problems, it's not Donald Trump. My thing is, he's a symptom. He's not a cause. We have deeper causes that we need to look at.
Well, you know, in a certain sense, and obviously there are many people who want to say the president is the problem. Well, we have lots of problems, and certainly he belongs in that constellation of problems. But I think it's also one of the realities we are in the current world is that we really gravitate towards silver bullets, and we gravitate towards simple solutions. And if we can say, well, he's the problem, if we deal with that, and unfortunately or fortunately, life's a little bit more complex than that. And there's a lot of things that we have to deal with to foster the common good and our own personal development.
Yeah, and following up on that point, I agree with what you said. It's also the thing I want to look at and start thinking about is post-Trump. Look, if he's defeated in 2020 or in 2024, he can't run again. There are a lot of people who don't like him. I mean, I find him vulgar and so much of the thing that's degrading to our civil discourse. But so many people look to politics as a solution. Oh, if we get him out in 2020, all will be good. We'll get a Democrat back in. No, that's, you know, what I think we're not good at as a country, which again, we can take a lesson from the church and from any religion, but is the idea of penance, of examining our past. We, as Americans, we love to just move on, right?
Right.
We do something, we do a misadventure overseas, people are killed, we do, you know, the Trump era here, people are, you know, lamented, say this is terrible. Look, if we don't actually go back and look at what happened and maybe think about penance. You know, in South Africa after apartheid, they had a peace and reconciliation commission. We're not good at looking back. You know, we're a very religious nation, but we don't like to examine our own sins. We just like to move ahead. Tomorrow's another day.
Right.
We've got a new president. Everything's good. I don't think that's the way.
Well, I think, and one of the things I think our Catholic perspectives brings to this, which again is, I would argue, is not very popular in the brand of civic religion that is part of this culture, is we want to win as Catholics. I mean, we think the greatest victory of all times is the resurrection, that Jesus conquered sin and death, but it was through the cross, it was through sacrifice. And what I think we've gotten to a little bit as a country, and I've talked about this show too, as Catholics, is, yeah, we want the resurrection. We want solutions. We want things to be better. But we're not willing to say what I'm going to sacrifice. What am I going to sacrifice in order to kind of do that? We want, you know, we always like when the pie gets bigger, because then nobody has to take a lesser slice. Well, sacrifice is at the essence of our Christian belief, our Christian thing. And I have said on this show a number of times, I think we're wimpy Catholics when it comes to sacrifice during Lent. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we say now means sacrifice. I've said it on the show. I said, I think our Muslim sisters and brothers, they understand real fasting when it comes to Ramadan, and we should incorporate some of that real sacrifice and fasting into our Lenten practices. So I'm tending to agree with you on where we are going and how we get there.
Yeah, and it's really, I agree with you 100%, and I think it's, again, it's one of those things that, you know, confess our sins and do penance and sin no more. But it's one of those things, obviously, we're always going to fall short.
Right.
That's not, the fact that, whatever, we elected, Donald Trump or Bill Clinton or whatever you want to think, look, there's always going to be problems, but it's what we do after that I think is going to be the test of our nation going forward.
So listen, you have been so generous with your time. Thank you. David Gibson is the director of the Center for Religion and Culture at Fordham University. He's also a journalist. He covered the Vatican for a while. He was on Vatican Radio. David, thanks so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you so much, Monsignor.
We're going to take a break. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You can follow me on Twitter at MSGRK Sullivan, or you can learn a little bit more about the topics we talk about on my Just Love blog. We'll be back in just a minute or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. This is our weekly conversation when we look at what's going on in the world through our prism of Catholic social wisdom, of Catholic social values. We just spoke about some of those issues with David Gitson, the director of Fordham University's Center for Religion and Culture. And a little bit later on in the show, we're going to be speaking with Suzanne Nossel, who is the executive director of Penn, which works to advance First Amendment rights and a free press. So we're going to be talking with her in a few minutes. And Tom, we have some news notes. At the end of the year, we always kind of come up to that time when people say, well, this is the event of the year, this is the person of the year, or something like that. And we also have words of the year, don't we?
We do, Monsignor. Actually, this past week, Merriam-Webster Dictionaries online published their word of the year. And the word for 2017, Monsignor, is feminism. The online site based this on analysis of searching traffic and announced that it showed a 70% increase in searches since on the word feminism since 2016. Merriam-Webster defines feminism as the theory of political, economic, social equality of the sexes, and organized activity on behalf of women's and women's rights. Other top words this year that were looked up were also complicit, rescue, and empathy. And as Merriam-Webster said, no one word can encapsulate all the news or events or stories in a given year. But when we look back over the past 12 months and combine the analysis of words that have been looked up much more frequently than previous years, with instances of intense spikes of interest because of news events, we see one word stand out in both categories, and that word was feminism.
That's interesting, because there was another, I think, group of people who are another organization that I think named the word complicit as the word of the year. Now, sometimes they use all different types of criteria. Got to tell you, I'm a little surprised that feminism got to be the top word, because it seems to me, in the word feminism, and where that kind of came into a lot of conversation, that's decades old, isn't it? I mean, it's not a new word, right?
I think so, Monsieur. I mean, feminism, I mean, I always think, if you think of feminism, my thinking always goes back to the 1970s and Gloria Steinem. That's what pops up about feminism. But what Merriam-Webster said was that it spiked at a number of times. The word feminism spiked in this past January after the Women's March. It spiked, actually, they said, after that, when Kellyanne Conway said in an interview she didn't consider herself a feminist. It spiked again also when female storylines in the media came up, for example, with Wonder Woman. And, of course, it spiked again just recently with a lot of the allegations that have come out about, abuse of power and men abusing women in public places.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, as we talked about last week on the show, I do think, topics related to feminism and the topics of sexual assault, sexual harassment, are incredibly different, because there is absolutely, to me, no ambiguity at all about how wrong, how bad, how awful, disgraceful, whatever words we want to use, sexual assault, sexual harassment. There is nothing to be said about that, except that it is unacceptable, and we have to do everything we can to make sure that those are reduced and God willing, eliminated from not only the workplace, but from our world. The issue of feminism, it strikes me, is an issue which is very, very important, and it's very complex, because it deals, in my judgment, with kind of trying to make sure there is equality, there's evenness, there's fairness, and how that plays out in different cultures and different places is a lot of work to figure that out. And so it's a concept which is an absolutely wonderful concept of equality, lack of discrimination, all of that. How you get there and what exactly it means is something that is basically what a society has to deal with over the long term and spend a lot of energy doing it. But again, it's a topic that is critically important. Unfortunately, it's been around for decades. Fortunately, there is progress that has been made, and unfortunately, there's still a lot of room to grow. Now, my disclaimer right now, I am a male, and therefore it's my perspective, and somebody who is actually living through the situation because they have been a victim of discrimination or lack of fair pay or lack of advancement, because they're a woman, they certainly have a very different perspective. And I certainly, that needs to be taken into consideration. Tom, why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll go to our next guest. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You can follow me on my Just Love follow more about the topics we do on my Just Love blog, and you can follow me on Twitter at MSGRKSullivan, and you can learn more about the topics that we talk about. Join us when we come back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, your neighbor, and yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We look at the world through perspectives of our Catholic social values, and we look at those topics and we try to figure out, by our looking at them, how the world could be more just and it could be more compassionate. So we're going to speak now with Suzanne Nossel, who is the executive director of PEN, which is an organization that works to advance First Amendment rights and a free press. She was also recently a panelist on the center, at the center, that our first guest, David Gibson, is the director of, and it was talking about the moral center of America. So, Suzanne Nossel, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love today.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So, tell us a little bit about PEN. What's that organization about?
We are an organization of writers with a mission to both celebrate and defend freedom of expression. So, we work to defend imperiled writers all over the world, people who are targeted because of something that they've written or expressed, and they may be prosecuted. threatened, jailed, and we work on their behalf so they feel they're not alone. They've got a community of writers that will rise to their defense. And then we work on issues of free expression more broadly. And I run PEN America, which is the American branch of PEN worldwide. Traditionally, a lot of our work has been global. It still is. But over the last year, we have intensified our work on threats to free expression here in the United States. We see threats that we are used to encountering around the world now on our own doorstep, attacks on media freedom and on journalists, efforts to impair our discourse, the spread of fake news. So we have our hands full.
I guess there's a lot. You don't get bored in trying to do what you're doing these days, do you?
No, boredom is not the problem. It's, exhaustion and a sense of being, responding every day in and day out to developments and also try to take the long view and defend open discourse on campus, defend the flow of information and news from being corrupted by people with fraudulent intent who mean to deceive. So it's both a short-term challenge of reacting to what's happening, a lot of which is coming out of Washington, daily attacks on the role of the media in our society, and also working in the longer horizon to build an empowered, informed constituency of people who are ready to fight for these rights.
You know, it seems to me, as somebody who is not a journalist and somebody who is not a writer, it seems to me that probably the threats are from a variety of sources and in different ways. I think there are probably those who kind of intentionally are trying to distort reality and facts and things like that. And then there are probably also those who are lazy, who are ignorant, who are egomaniacs, and they think just because they think something is there, they just kind of put it out there without it being vetted at all. And that must make it very complex to try to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have a spectrum of things that get dubbed fake news. You know, there are genuine mistakes. You know, journalists, like anybody else, make mistakes. Now they get called out very vociferously. You know, there are instances of exaggeration that get called fake news. There are falsehoods that a politician or a public figure articulate and voice. You know, is that fake news? Well, he really said it. So reporting on it is reporting truthfully, but, you know, what he said is false. And then there are genuinely false stories that are put forward by people knowing that they're false, you know, with a particular, it can be financial or political purpose in mind. So understanding these distinctions and kind of dealing appropriately with each type is very important. And, you know, then finally we have the problem of, out of the White House, a president who calls virtually any media coverage that he doesn't like fake news. He dubs it fake news. So his definition of fake news is something different entirely.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I would probably consider the president probably it's the highest office in the land, so he should do it better than anybody else. But I've rarely met a politician who hasn't considered something false that if it disagreed with him or didn't say something nice about him. The president has kind of raised that to an incredibly new level of dubbing it kind of false and fake. So that adds another.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, he's not the first politician to, you know, cry falsehood when on the receiving end of negative reporting. And, you know, we've seen other people, in our discourse, including people on the left, do that.
Right.
And, you know, it's sort of now, you know, no, but for him, I think you have to realize it's part of a larger playbook and a deliberate effort to discredit the media. So it's a strategy. I think for a lot of people, when they say that, you know, it's reactive, they've read something that doesn't ring true or that is upsetting, you know, whereas for him, I think it's a long-term campaign to confuse people about what is true and sort of put forward an alternative narrative. So
what do we do? What do we do about it?
You know, it's tough. I mean, there are a whole series of things. You know, we haven't talked about the role of social media platforms, which now are the primary channels through which people get their news. you know, and when you bring up, you know, their new, the idea of new threats, it's not just the White House. That's absolutely true. I mean, some people are calling for these platforms to take on new responsibilities to vet content, potentially censor content. And I think that's dangerous. I think it's very difficult to draw lines. So that in this country, you know, we've always had the highest standard of protection for freedom of expression in the world. And I think that's an important part of our national identity and why we've been successful in a whole range of realms. So I think that's not the answer, and that the best solution lies in an informed, educated, equipped, and conscientious news consumer. You know, so if you think about back in the day when news consumers mobilized to demand safer cars and safer water and safer food, we now need consumers to rise up and demand accurate news, to be informed about the source of news, to be able to get beyond the story and validate it and understand what work went into it and whether it's something that they can believe. It, you know, we, when we grew up, when you saw something that was printed in a book or a magazine or even something that used to be called an encyclopedia, it had gone through layers of editing, fact-checking. Now people get their information from this, you know, ocean online. They don't know whether it's gone through any of that kind of verification process, who's looked at it. They often don't know the source of it. And so we need to develop a new set of tools, a new level of education for our students so that they can swim and navigate this ocean without drowning.
We're speaking with Suzanne Nossel, who is the executive director of PEN, which is an organization that tries to protect First Amendment rights and tries to kind of foster the kind of integrity of journalism and dealing with some of the really difficult issues that are in our current environment, in which there's, you know, attempt by kind of making a brand fake news to discredit everybody who's doing a decent journalism, trying to report the truth. And, you know, in some circles, fake news simply means if you've said something mean about me or something that I don't like. So, so Suzanne, I mean, we talked a little bit about this, but, and I don't mean to be overly depressing, but this seems like a tidal wave and like, can we do it? Can we stop? I mean, I don't know.
You know, I think we're at a difficult moment right now where these threats are new. They're newly recognized. You know, we're now realizing also that when it comes to the process of public regulation and members of the public submitting comments, that overwhelmingly these comments may be fake. They may be produced by bots. So when an agency like the Federal Communications Commission is trying to ascertain public opinion, a primary channel that they utilize now has been fundamentally corrupted. So I think, you know, ultimately our creativity, our ingenuity, the engineers, the algorithms, our system of public education, our media, our legal institutions, you know, will help us find a way through and get to a point where our information ecosystem is better protected, where consumers have the tools to understand the information they're receiving and how to weight and credit it. But it's going to take some time. It's going to take a real effort and sort of a focus on this problem. It's not going to happen naturally. You know, we're in a time of fundamental change technologically, demographically in this country, and it's an adjustment that can be painful at times.
Well, and also, I can't come up with a business model that works. I mean, and I'll give you an example of a guest that I had on my show last week. The guest was the archaeological editor of National Geographic, and a completely different set of topics. But National Geographic had been given the exclusive on the uncovering, for the first time in centuries, the place where has been honored and thought to be the grave of Jesus in Jerusalem. And she went in there with her camera crew and everything, and she had the exclusive as they were going through it. And what she said to us, she said, and there were 50 people with their cell phones there who posted the pictures on their Facebook and their Twitter accounts. And so before they even edited the film, all the news and all the story was out there. And it seemed to me, when she told me that, I said, boy, what's the business model that says it's worth, you know, a news organization spending tens of thousands of dollars covering something if, you know, an amateur with a cell phone, you know, gets it out there first?
Yeah, it's a real problem. I mean, all of this comes at a time of enormous pressure and transformation for the news media, the decline of print advertising and subscription-based businesses that have been the traditional source of revenue for those companies. And so they're in the midst of this adaptation. I mean, in some ways, the Trump era has been a boon for the news media because they are seeing spikes in numbers of viewers, in subscribers, in some cases in profitability. And so that creates a cushion. Yeah, but they're being forced to be very creative, and sometimes that creativity can come at the expense of the credibility of journalism. There's a rush to get things out. They're operating in a 24-hour news cycle, trying to beat one another to get the scoop. Sometimes that leads to inaccuracy. You know, you see on cable news that by far the cheapest way to program is to have all these talking heads. It can be very difficult to discern who's an actual reporter and has been busy investigating and ferreting out new information so that what you're watching really is news, and you know, who's simply a commentator, and they may be a commentator representing a campaign or a political party, but when you see them on these news shows, they're all sitting side by side, and it can be very hard to parse who's who to trust, how to interpret the content that you're receiving. So I think the economic pressures definitely add a layer of complexity as we resolve this, because you know, it is to make the news media more transparent, to make allow consumers to access more information about sourcing and methods of reporting, all that will cost money. So it's a, I think, essential public trust and a dimension, a fourth estate in our society that our democracy depends on. So we have to fortify these institutions, but it is
there,
a challenging moment.
Is there one particular project or initiative of Penn that you're currently working on that is attempting to do that?
You know, we just put out a report on the problem of fake news called Faking the News and the Fight for Truth. And in it, we outline the risk that fake news poses for our democracy. I mean, some people say, look, fake news is protected speech. And that's true. Under the First Amendment, just because something is false doesn't make it illegal. You know, you're allowed to lie. You can publish whatever you want. You know, there's no right for the government to interfere with that. But nonetheless, we cast this as a threat to free expression and to open discourse. I mean, our view is that if you don't know what's true and what's false, all the value of freedom of expression for all of us is undermined. You know, it's not just the right to speak. It's also the right to be heard, to be listened to, you know, to be believed. And so all that gets undercut in an environment where fake news is running rampant. And we set out a whole series of recommendations for newsrooms, for social media companies, for news consumers, and we're now hard at work to implement those, engaging with different partners. We're engaging with Penn members across the country in communities to discuss how this plays out at the local level with local media. So it's a broad-based effort.
Suzanne, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and engaging in what is a very, very important project in an incredibly difficult environment. So thank you for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Suzanne Nossel, who is the executive director of Penn America, talking about the problem that we have of getting accurate news in this era, in this time. And it's not an easy task. It's a difficult task. I want to share with our listeners an experience I had this past week. And it's a very, very simple thing, but I think it's something that indicates how people doing their jobs well in an unassuming way can make such a difference in the lives of people and in the way things work. So I was getting on the commuter rail train on Saturday evening. I was going to an event outside of New York City. I was going to take the train there. Now, this past weekend, at least in New York City, was one of those events that has become pretty rowdy called SantaCon, in which lots of people dress up as Santa Claus, men and women, and they go from bar to bar, and oftentimes they have more than a little more to drink. And towards the end of the day, they can be pretty rowdy and more than a little disturbing in different ways. So this past Saturday, I'm getting on the train, and there is a conductor of the train who's standing on the platform. And as all of the people dressed like Santa Claus are coming down, pretty rowdy, in a very, very understated way, he kind of pointed them towards the front of the train, that they should get into the train, and they kind of kept on. They were continuing their partying and everything. And then the other people who weren't dressed as SantaCons, just people going their way, getting on the commuter train, he would point them toward the back of the train. And this gentleman, this conductor, knew his business. He knew that if you put all of the people, the SantaCon people together, they'd probably have a good time. They might be a little rowdy, but they'd be with everybody else and life would go on and the train would go there. And if you put the people who weren't part of it in the other part of the train, they'd have a peaceful ride. They would go on. If he didn't do that, I bet you would have gotten some of the rowdy people with the not party people, and tempers could have flared. Maybe somebody had too much to drink, wouldn't have liked some of the other people. We could have had a lot of incidents. So I'm holding him up as kind of my worker of the week for, in an unassuming way, went out of his way to make the world a better place, more just, more compassionate. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. Follow my blog, Monsignor, thejustblog.com. Follow me on Twitter, MSGRK Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.